It is Friday, March 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson calls for a new approach to North Korea.
If North Korea takes actions that threatens the South Korean forces or our own forces, then that will be met with an appropriate response.
Turkey's president escalates his condemnation of the European Union, and the latest book by Chinese-American author Lisa Si explores adoption and U.S.-China ties. It's all ahead. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has again emphasized the need for a new approach to deal with the growing North Korean nuclear threat. He spoke in South Korea Friday.
All the options are on the table. Certainly, we do not want for things to get to a military conflict. We're quite clear in that in our communications. But obviously, if North Korea takes actions that threatens the South Korean forces or our own forces, then that will be met with an appropriate response.
In his first official trip to Asia this week, Tillerson is visiting North Korea's key neighboring countries, Japan, South Korea, and China. I spoke with VOA Northeast Asia correspondent Brian Padden about Tillerson's remarks.
He again emphasized that exact phrase, a new approach was needed. He again emphasized that 20 years of past policies of engagement and sanctions have failed, that $1.3 billion of economic aid that has been provided by the United States to North Korea has had little effect in persuading or encouraging, as he said, North Korea to take a different path away from developing nuclear weapons. But he also gave us some more details. He said the focus would be on escalating economic actions and measures that could be taken to put more pressure on North Korea. That would be the first and foremost thing that he's talking to officials in Tokyo, Seoul, and then Beijing about. He has not ruled out the military option and said that if the North Korean threat level reaches such a level where action is required, they would consider a military response as well. But for the most part, he's relying on more effective sanctions and economic pressure and diplomatic pressure. Although he said that the time of the policy of strategic patience, referring back to Obama's policies, that time is over. The measures that he talked about seem to be just a little bit more aggressive than those that the Obama administration had been pursuing, increasing economic sanctions against North Korea in the last year. The U.S. worked with China to impose the harshest sanctions yet on the Kim Jong-un regime. Mr. Tillerson wants those sanctions to be fully implemented, especially by China. And he said that there are other measures that can be taken, unilateral measures that can be taken that the U.S. will be looking at, and that Washington will also be working with other countries to get them to fully implement measures. So he wants to increasingly cut off North Korea from the economic world.
What kind of reaction have South Korean officials given to Mr. Tillerson's comments?
Another thing that he did talk about was the issue of THAAD. THAAD is this advanced U.S. missile defense system that is being deployed here in South Korea, and China has strongly objected to it and has informally started implementing some limits on imports and tourists to South Korea to punish the government here and to punish the country here for deploying this system. Secretary of State Tillerson implored China to ease up on these sanctions and said it's a troubling development and not the way a regional power should act. In that regard, the current government, the conservative-led government that's currently in power, was very much supportive of everything that the U.S. Secretary of State said, that they very much endorsed the stronger sanctions regimes that he suggested, but aware that here in South Korea there is a dramatic political change underway. There will be a new presidential election in early May, And that is because the president who was elected to originally to fill out a term until the end of this year, President Park Geun-hye, she was impeached recently for her alleged involvement in a bribery and influence peddling scandal. And the opposition parties, who are much more liberal and not particularly in favor of FAD and more in favor of engagement and developing incentives to offer North Korea to give up their nuclear program, that party seems poised to take power in early May.
VOA Northeast Asia correspondent Brian Patton speaking from Seoul. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's going on?
Well, there's a lot of people weighing in on this story, including none other than President Trump, tweeting out not too long ago, North Korea is behaving very badly. They have been playing the United States for years. China has done little to help. Now, it's interesting to note here that he mentions North Korea, which, of course, is the northern neighbor of South Korea, where Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, just was. And he also mentions China, which is where he's going to next. So not a mistake that he mentioned those two areas. There's also a lot of conversation on social media about the lack of a press corps traveling or a press pool traveling with the Secretary of State. It's very unusual. There's only one reporter that's traveling with him and hasn't filed anything yet. And so
that's interesting.
It's garnered a lot of attention on social media. And as a result, we're getting reports from South Korean media, but not U.S. media, including one that said that the Secretary of State cut short some meetings because he was fatigued. So lack of information is really frustrating people on social media. They are taking notice of that. The other big news, of course, around the world is St. Patrick's Day. So you see a lot of people wearing green all over. Everybody's a little bit Irish today. You see not just the green clothes, but I think my favorite, the green food, which always looks like it's spoiled. In New York, they have green bagels, for example, and green beer, that kind of thing. And there's also, on a more serious note, a lot of parallels being made between Irish immigrants who came to the U.S. en masse in the early 1900s and the current immigration ban that has been proposed. And to that end, the Irish Taoiseach, Enda Kenny, was at the White House yesterday for St. Patrick's Day celebrations. And in a toast to President Trump, spoke about how St. Patrick was an immigrant and is, in fact, the patron saint of immigrants and how all those Irish came to the United States looking for a better life. Some very pointed words in this toast that people have seized on. This video has gone viral. They said it was a thinly veiled criticism at the immigration ban that the administration has proposed.
Yeah, a lot of comment on that on social media.
Yes.
And another thing I just wanted to bring out, you were talking about things in green. I believe in Chicago, they even dye the river.
They do.
Green.
It's a sight to see, for sure. And those pictures were actually trending when they did that.
I don't know how environmentally friendly that is, but
I think it's safe. But they said that sometimes it makes the river look even nicer. Usually it has kind of a murky brown color. So brightens it up for even a day.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. A U.S. airstrike rounds out a brutal anniversary week in Syria's war. Somali refugees are killed off the coast of Yemen. Dozens are detained, including Afghans, in Pakistan's security crackdown. And South Africa proposes sweeping immigration policy changes. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers using two of NASA's X-ray space telescopes, as well as the Australia Telescope Compact Array, say they have found evidence of the tightest orbit of a companion star around a black hole. The star, a white dwarf, is said to circle the black hole at a rate of 2 times an hour from a distance equal to 2.5 times the separation between Earth and the Moon. The black hole white dwarf system was identified as X9, located in a Milky Way globular star cluster nearly 15,000 light years from Earth. The scientists say the white dwarf is so close to the cosmic abyss that stellar material is being stripped away and dumped into a disk of matter surrounding the black hole before it's pulled in by the tremendous gravity. While they don't think the white dwarf is in any danger of falling in or being torn apart by the black hole, the researchers say its fate is uncertain. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we hear about an Oregon town that is up for sale. Turkey's president continues to ratchet up tensions with the European Union as he campaigns ahead of an April referendum to extend his presidential powers. The unprecedented rhetoric is raising concerns as to whether Turkish-EU relations can recover. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, having already accused EU, Germany and the Netherlands of being fascist and Nazis, has extended his war of words to the entire bloc. Erdogan accused EU countries of persecuting Muslims, like Jews during World War II, and that the spirit of fascism was running wild on the streets of Europe. In the meantime, Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu warned that Europe will be the site of what he called holy wars that will ultimately destroy it. The comments follow a European Court of Human Rights ruling that businesses could ban their employees from wearing religious symbols, including Islamic headscarves, in certain circumstances. Political consultant Attila Yeşilada of Global Source Partners says the attacks on Europe are an attempt by Erdogan to consolidate nationalist and religious voters ahead of next month's referendum. Yeşilada warns, with opinion polls indicating the referendum too close to call, EU-Turkish relations are set to face their greatest test.
It is the most crucial vote in his political career. If the whole idea is to bolster the vote for the Yes camp, they need to invent new tricks to get this fight going with EU until mid-April, because otherwise it will fade off. These shocks fade off in a week at most. And what they will invent to further annoy Europe above and beyond, you know, outrageous insults, I really don't know.
For now, Erdogan's attacks on Europe have only been confined to rhetoric. Despite repeated threats of sanctions at Germany and the Netherlands for banning Turkish ministers speaking at rallies of ethnic Turks, until now there have only been a few diplomatic measures. Erdogan warned Thursday, however, that a key refugee deal with Europe could be at risk. Last year's deal, which is marking its first anniversary, helped stem the mass influx of migrants into Europe. Interior Minister Süleyman Soylu said 15,000 refugees a month should be sent to Europe to shock them. Analysts suggest Ankara would be reluctant to end the refugee deal, being key to maintaining relations with the EU as well as important leverage. Political columnist Semih Yildiz of Al Monitor website says the refugee deal will probably help prevent a severing of ties, but warns relations may have been irreparably damaged.
It's going to take a lot of hard diplomacy to backtrack and to put things back on track. I mean, obviously, for Europe, for its own interests, will maintain things. But, you know, a wedge has been driven between the government in Turkey that represents Turkey at the moment and Europe. So it's not going to be easy.
With the outcome of the referendum in the balance, and with it, some claim, even the future of the president himself, observers say Erdogan and his government remain focused just on winning the vote, whatever the cost, which could mean more trouble for Europe. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Looking to buy a U.S. town? Well, there's one up for sale, although one bid is being seriously considered. The town is Tiller, Oregon, located about 360 kilometers south of Portland, a mostly uninhabited, unincorporated town founded more than 100 years ago that emptied out with the decline of timber harvesting. Price tag, just under $4 million. Timothy O'Neill and his real estate partner Garrett Zoller are handling the transaction. O'Neill spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty.
The family that owns the parcels put them all together over the last couple of decades, just buying properties as people moved out of the town. It used to be a logging town. It includes all the water rights, storage tanks, the water systems, the minerals in the town. It's got a mile of the North Umpqua River on both sides of the river and about 2 million board feet of merchantable timber. on the property and then surrounded by national forest.
Pictures of it are gorgeous, and so it could be a very attractive property for somebody to own. I understand, according to your colleague, Garrett, that you fielded calls from buyers ranging from Chinese investors to people interested in starting medical facilities.
Yes, sir.
Any of them seriously interested?
We've already had an offer on the property. We got 165 emails this morning in response to our video going viral.
From all over the world?
All over the world, yes.
It's an unusual situation where an actual town goes up for sale. That's why this has such interest in the media.
Sure. And, you know, it gives somebody the opportunity to put their own little community together. I mean, because there's lots that are zoned commercial, there's lots that are zoned industrial, there's a platted subdivision already built into the town with its own water system and everything. I mean, it's getting a lot of interest.
It's a town that dates back to the turn of the 19th to 20th century, so it's probably over 100 years old?
Yes, sir.
This involves six homes, an apartment, I understand, industrial commercial lots, and a building that once housed a gas station and general store. Are there actual residents who live there?
Yeah, there's two residents that live there now, one of the school teachers and also the pastor of the town and the family that owns the town. But most of the residents have moved out. The town is still in really good shape. It's been very well cared for.
Does the state of Oregon have any say about who actually buys the property?
I don't believe so.
So this is a completely private sale, no matter who actually is the final owner?
Yes, sir. And the actual school is for sale, too.
So you're hoping to wrap up a deal very soon?
Yes, sir, we are. We think with the interest we've had, we're probably on the way of putting a deal together real soon.
If anyone listens to this interview and they say, boy, I would love to own a U.S. town, is it too late for them?
Oh, no, I don't think so. Certainly, you know, I know real estate well, and I'll tell you what, it's not over until it's over. So even if we do pencil a deal on the town, we're always interested in backup offers.
Timothy O'Neill's partner, Garrett Zoeller, called the community a developer's dream. It is rare, he said, for that amount of land and property to go on sale for development from scratch. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondence, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
This is International Edition. Expanding ties between China and the United States form the backdrop of Lisa See's latest novel, The Tea Girl of Hummingbird Lane. VOA's Mike O'Sullivan spoke with the author, who says her book is about China's growing prosperity, cross-cultural adoption, and the enduring bond between mothers and daughters.
Lisa See has chronicled the Chinese experience in California in a 1995 book called On Gold Mountain. She says the West Coast state is a cultural crossroads and the source of ideas for fictional stories like that in her new novel.
My husband and I were walking to the movies, and we saw ahead of us a sort of older white couple with their teenage Chinese adopted daughter walking between them.
The image of a carefree family would lead to a tale of intercultural adoption and the growing commercial ties between the United States and China. See is the author of such best-selling works as Snowflower and the Secret Fan and Shanghai Girls, and her books are based on-the-ground research. A tea-tasting demonstration in America led her to Yunnan Province, China, a tea-growing region in the southwestern part of the country.
They have more varieties of plant life in that one province of China than all together in the rest of the Northern Hemisphere. They have more species of animals in that one province of China, which is only 4% of China's overall landmass, than in the rest of China combined. And that biodiversity also applies to human beings.
The region is home to half of China's 55 ethnic minorities, and they include a tea-growing hill tribe called the Akha. She met an Akha family whose daughter collected stories from her elders, and the writer was fascinated.
And so she just told us these unbelievable stories about her family, about the neighbors, about her own experience, so that by the end of that day, I knew that I wanted to write about the Akha.
Xi's novel concerns an Akha woman named Li Yan, who gives birth to a daughter out of wedlock. Defying local customs that call for the child's death, she takes her to an orphanage, and the child, renamed Haley, is adopted by an American family. Haley questioned her identity, as did the real-life adoptees that she met in her research.
And there was one girl who, I think, summed it up for me when she said, "I know I'm lucky, and I know my parents love me, and I know I'm the most precious person in our family. But I wasn't precious enough for my birth parents to keep." And that's a pretty heavy thing to carry with you through your life.
The book explores this tension as the story unfolds in both America and China, where Haley's birth mother rides the wave of prosperity as Chinese products, including the local tea, find a worldwide market. The separate paths of mother and daughter bring both to Los Angeles, where Xi says she is doing her own exploration of family connections reflected in her novels.
The listeners can't see me. I have red hair and freckles, but I actually grew up in a very large Chinese-American family here in Los Angeles. I have about 400 relatives here. There are about a dozen that look like me. The majority are still full Chinese, and then this little spectrum in between.
Xi's books all feature Chinese or Chinese-Americans, and her fiction focuses on women. The Tea Girl of Hummingbird Lane follows these themes as it looks at changes that prosperity brings to one ethnic community in the hills of southwestern China. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
That's our show. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Over the past two decades, much of East Africa has suffered through recurrent droughts resulting in failed crops, dying cattle, and escalating food prices. The result is hunger, undernutrition, and suffering for millions of people. This year, the rains have been scant, more so than usual. This is exacerbating drought in the Horn of Africa, particularly in Somalia, Ethiopia, and Kenya, where around 15 million people are suffering from food insecurity as a result. The Famine Early Warning Systems Network, or FUSENET, which is funded by the U.S. Agency for International Development as well as the Food Security and Nutrition Analysis Unit for Somalia, are sounding the alarm in Somalia. They estimate that half of Somalia's population of 12.3 million people is facing hunger or starvation. The southern agricultural and pastoral areas and northeastern pastoral areas have been hardest hit. Over the past few years, food insecurity has been dropping in Ethiopia. The number of people requiring humanitarian assistance there has declined by half since late 2015. But as last year's October to December rains failed and drought conditions developed in the country's southern and southeastern regions, farmers and herders who had been unable to recover from the previous drought are once again in need of assistance. According to the government of Ethiopia and its relief partners, some 5.6 million people will need relief food assistance between January and December 2017. Kenya is also suffering from inadequate rainfall during both the March to May 2016 long rain season and the October to December short rain season. In some parts of northern Kenya, 70% of water sources are already dry and people are already suffering hunger. FUSENET projected in January that without sustained relief assistance, crisis-level acute food insecurity could occur in some drought-affected areas of Kenya in the coming months. So far this year, the United States government has committed more than $282 million for critical relief interventions in the Horn of Africa. We call on our global partners to join us in this effort.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.